Patristic Nectar Publications is pleased to present a four-part lecture series by Father Josiah Trenum entitled Male and Female, Reflections on Transgenderism. And now, Father Josiah. Lecture 2, The Significance of Male and Female.
I welcome you. This is our second lecture in our session, second session in our new series dedicated to Reflections on Transgenderism. I've entitled it Male and Female, Reflections on Transgenderism. And in fact, male and female and the significance of male and female, I'm going to dive into a little bit tonight. By way of review, we looked at the shocking speed in the last decade, really since 2012, in the development of the transgender movement last time we were together. I view this as the latest and perhaps most shocking offspring of the sexual revolution. It's not something that just appeared out of nowhere. It's something that's been going on aggressively for some time. This kind of sexual chaos rooted in anarchy, really a rejection of theological and natural norms that became very formal in the 1960s and is continuing to produce the most outrageous consequences. So this is a river of chaos flowing from the sexual revolution. It's been brought to us in a very aggressive way. We talked about the pronouns controversy, the both state and federal law now imposing all sorts of crazy definitions of sexuality, the complete embrace of this ideology, this transgender ideology by the public schools. Last time I went through the typical California calendar and the multiple celebrations of perversity and disorder as though they were wonderful things, the complete indoctrination. If you can think about the liturgical calendar and how the liturgical calendar molds us into Christians and teaches us the gospel and how to think and how to feel and what to celebrate and what to mourn, just imagine the demonic imitation of that. And there is this secular state calendar in our school system that celebrates all the wrong things and creates dispositions and happiness and sadness based upon lies and destructive realities, sadly. And then we spent most of our time last week talking about the explosion of rapid onset gender dysphoria as a social contagion rooted in this ideology together with on steroids because of the smartphone and social media. Since we were together last, of course, there's never a day that there isn't some new news in transgender insanity. But since we were together last week, the largest of the main Lutheran bodies in the United States, the ELCA, there's three major Lutheran bodies, the ELCA, the Missouri Synod, and the Wisconsin Synod. The largest is the ELCA. They just installed their first transgender bishop. Yes. And guess where? You got it. Right here in California. And the consecration of her, who's really a him, took place. It couldn't have taken place any place more appropriate. Where, of all places? Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. The Episcopalian Cathedral in San Francisco. You know, it's a beautiful Norman structure. You would think that it, with its architectural connections to traditional Christianity, that there might be something Christian going on, but you're out of luck, completely 100% out of luck. The first time I ever went to Grace Cathedral, I was a young man. I had driven up to San Francisco. I had just become Orthodox, and I wanted to go see this incredible Norman structure. And I walked in the narthex, and I saw two icons on the east wall. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is so wonderful. Icons! Until I got a little closer, and I found out that one of them was an icon of Martin Luther King. And one was an icon of Harvey Milk. In the Episcopal Cathedral in San Francisco. Yeah, so I learned a lot about that quote-unquote church. Megan Rohr is the name of this new transgender bishop for the Lutherans. The Lutherans and the Anglicans have a collaborative liturgical agreement. I think it's about 15 years old now, so they do stuff in each other's churches. And so, of course, they had it in the Grace Cathedral, the consecration of this transgender woman. And she said afterwards that she was proud of her church because they, quote, prayerfully did a historic thing, unquote. Prayerfully did a historic thing. This is just another example. As I said, every week there's something, some more insanity. Of course, it's the most pernicious to give the cloak of religion to this perversity, which is exactly what the ELCA is doing, these pathetic Lutherans. It's really quite sad. And of course, it's being aggressively brought in, not just a schoolroom, but it's all over the television now. I read an interesting article by the Orthodox social commentator Rod Dreher. I'm sure some of you know Rod. The Benedict Option, Live Not by Lies. He's a really wonderful thinker. Anyway, he wrote an article recently about The Wiggles. The Wiggles is a cartoon. It's an Australian cartoon, but it's really well known. And The Wiggles have gone woke, and some of the main figures in The Wiggles are now transgender. The unicorn's transgender. She is identifying now as gender non-binary, and blah, blah, blah. Really colonizing, he describes it as colonizing the minds of pre-kindergarten children, such that they could grow up and have that be just normal. They think it's just normal. And of course, if you grow up thinking that gender ideology is normal, and then you meet someone like us, we're the weird people, right? This is the logic of the movement. Rod calls it therapeutic totalitarianism. A lot of our kids have gone back to school now, and some of them in the UC system, which a lot of the UCs start right now. And this is the core message of orientation in the UC system. They want to know what pronouns the incoming students want to be known by. Tell me your pronouns. It's just part of orientation. It's that fundamental. How else could you know? This is how crazy it's been. Tonight, I want you to think a little bit about the meaning of male and female. You know, our foundational text, the foundational text of all of Scripture, comes from the first book of Moses called Genesis. And in Genesis 1-3, in the account of the creation of the whole world, and especially of man and woman, God spends a lot of time making clear distinctions that become fundamental to build a life on the truth. The first and most important distinction is the distinction between himself and his creation. What's called in theology the creator-creature distinction. If you don't get this, you can't know anything. You can't know who God is, and you can't understand what a human being is or what the creation is. The uncreated God outside of creation, before creation, brought all things into existence from nothing as an expression of his glory and for his own purposes. There's not anything in all of creation that doesn't have his fingerprint, so to speak, on it, his intentionality, his meaning infused in it, which is why we can live in a world that we know as our Father's. It's why we can sense him and know him in his creation and in each other. This is the first great distinction God makes between himself and everything that's created. And then within creation, the second major distinction God makes is between mankind and the rest of creation. Mankind is absolutely unique. Mankind uniquely is made in his image and called to become according to his likeness. This is what a human being is. A human being unlike the animals, unlike the plants, unlike the mountains, isn't just stuff. We're not just stuff. We're not just matter. There's a part of us which is from the breath of God. He fashioned us with his hands from the dirt, but he breathed a life-giving soul into us. And so we're more than what can be defined by earthly things. There is an eternality about human beings. There's an essential connection to God And then a further distinction that God makes in these opening chapters of Genesis is the distinction within mankind. So the first is between himself and all creation. The second is between mankind and the rest of creation. And the third is between mankind himself. And that essential difference is what is male and what is female. The distinction that God fashions in the human species itself. Sex, the sex of a human person, contrary to the transgender ideologues who are promoting their nonsense in the West, is not assigned by a doctor at birth. This is the new language that they're using that they want us to adopt. Sex is something assigned at birth. Rather, it's established by God at conception. When a sperm and an egg fuse to form a single cell embryo that we call a zygote. This is just standard material. Standard medical school textbooks on embryology are clear that sex is determined at fertilization. The sperm carrying an X chromosome produces a female XX embryo. A sperm carrying a Y chromosome produces a male XY embryo. A new male or a new female human organism is created at that very moment. There never is a time when a human being is not either male or female. It has nothing to do with a doctor. It's not something that gets created because a doctor wrote it down on a piece of paper and assigned someone a sex at birth. In very rare occasions, the normal development is altered or disrupted by hormonal or chromosomal pathologies, but these are very rare and they are abnormalities. The existence of the abnormality doesn't refute the reality that human beings are dimorphic, that we are sexed as male and female. The sexual pattern of the genetic material of males and females has tremendous consequences in life. A person's sex is not just one aspect of their being. It's not just a reflection of having an XX or an XY sexual chromosome. It's something much more influential. It has everything to do with how a person is organized to function. The most obvious differences between male and female are how they are organized for human reproduction, for sure. Sexual distinctions are the most obvious. But together we have a joint physical potential to reproduce. And so to understand the telos of the real purpose of why we're creating, why God created a man or a woman, it's necessary to understand the telos or the purpose of the opposite sex. A man is known and understood in relationship to the female, and a female is known and understood in a relationship to the man. This has nothing to do with social creation. This is basic core identity. The human female gestates offspring. That's what she does. The male impregnates the female. In biology, an organism is male or female if it is structured to perform one of the respective roles in reproduction. There's no other widely accepted biological classification for the sexes. I'll read you a statement soon of a transgendered ideologue who is a medical doctor and an expert testimony and is trying to promote a whole new definition. But as of this moment, there is no other definition, biological classification for the sexes. Males donate genetic material. Females receive it. And they gestate the resulting offspring. Transgender advocates call this, quote, an extremely outdated view of biological sex. They call it an extremely outdated view of biological sex, but there is no other view in existence. There are no biologists, there are no geneticists who have come up with some new scientific definition that has been accepted. So it may be outdated socially. I'll give that to them. But it has nothing to do with science. This is a multi-species definition, by the way. It's not just about the human beings. This is how you determine what's a male and a female in multiple species. We have known for a long time that the XX or XY chromosomal composition determines female and male sex. We've known that since 1921. But we've only known why since 1959. Developmental testicular differentiation begins, we know now, in week 7 in the womb, as either testicles or ovaries begin to develop, and subsequently drives further sexual differentiation as they secrete sex-specific hormones, which drive sexual differentiation development downstream, so to speak, as the child continues to develop. Next, in the womb, develop our reproductive organs, external genitalia, sex hormones. And this development continues and then explodes again in puberty when the human being reaches sexual maturation. Apart from reproductive organs, baby boys and baby girls look very similar. They have very similar bodies. Even though then, newborn baby boys have longer bodies with more lean mass. During puberty, the bodies of the two sexes part ways, obviously. Girls pass through puberty and cease to grow at earlier ages than boys. Post-pubescent boys have greater height, greater total lean and mineral mass, and lower fat mass than do females. Males have greater arm muscle mass, larger and stronger bones, and very differently shaped bone structure. For this reason, females have a high greater risk of osteoporosis in old age. Men have reduced limb fat, but a similar degree of central abdominal fat. Men and women differ not only in their sex chromosomes and in their organization for reproduction, but they differ in size, shape, bone length and density, fat distribution, musculature, and many other organs. In fact, we don't know exactly in how each of the major organs and organ systems in the body differ, but we do know that they do. The brain, in fact, is, apart from reproductive organs, the most sexed organ in a human being, meaning it has the greatest, this organ has the greatest difference between men and women. We have differences in our brains that make a difference in how we experience pain, how we experience emotion, how we see, how we hear, how we remember, and how we navigate. Don't you know it? Dr. Larry Cahill, who is a well-known neurobiologist, in the journal Endocrinology, affirms that sex influences on brain function are in fact ubiquitous. They affect every level of neuroscience. Differences between the male and the female brain. Studies of young human beings as well as young monkeys show different preferences for toys between the sexes that cannot be explained by socialization or cultural stereotypes. Many studies have been done on day one of birth, before there was ever any time to socialize, and clear sexual differences with regards to preference for toys are shown to exist. Girls are more interested in their mothers than boys are. Girls prefer movies with faces. Boys prefer movies with cars. There are studies showing that these realities are independent of socialization. Socialization can enhance them. Male-female differences also have tremendous implications for health. Male and female bodies are susceptible to disease, the same disease, in different ways, to differing degrees. And male and female bodies respond to the same treatment in different ways. These undisputed discoveries have led to new sex-specific protocols in scientific medical studies. Women have better verbal abilities in general, and they recover verbal skills more quickly than men after suffering similar strokes. Men are more conceptual and focused on action. Male and female differences also manifest themselves in susceptibility to certain mental illnesses. there are some mental illnesses that women are more susceptible to, and some mental illnesses that men are more susceptible to. Men are more susceptible to autism, ADHD, Tourette syndrome, and dyslexia. Women are more susceptible to depression and anxiety disorder. Besides all of these unique biological realities of male-female sexual differentiation, I want to also add that the male-female distinction is more than just biology. There's more to the mystery of being male and female than even all the things I just mentioned. Even all the things I just mentioned show radical, complete person differentiation and uniqueness between being male and female. Life is a mystery. Which one of us doesn't know that there's more to us than our biology? A lot more. But biology, as you just saw, is exceedingly important because we're not just souls and we're not just bodies. We're enfleshed souls made in the image of God. And there's a lot that we can't describe about what it means to be a Christian, a person living in the mystery of union with God as a man, or living in the union with God as a woman. Living as a man or a woman in Christ involves many sex roles, many things that God leads us to that are unique. How to be a husband versus how to be a wife. A commonality, yes, of mutual love for God, of mutual submission to each other, the same ethical standards, yes. But there are different ways. There are ways that the husband is and ways that the wife is. The difference between being a Christian father and being a Christian mother. The difference between being a myrrh bearer and a priest that are beyond description in words. Changing your sex, the point is, changing your sex is simply impossible. You would have to change every single thing about yourself, every cell. Normally, a child's sex is obvious in utero and can be clearly discovered, certainly by a 20-week ultrasound. When a child is born, its sex is not assigned. It's recognized. It's acknowledged. That being said, let me turn to the second half of my talk, which is, how should we understand, interpret, and treat the tiny percent of cases where the normal is not in existence? How do we understand, interpret, and treat gender dysphoria? So we've overviewed the normal male and female development, but there do exist what are called disorders of sexual development, DSDs. Disorders of sexual development in about 1 out of every 5,000 births, we see the appearance of a DSD. And just for orienting yourself, in a country like ours, which has more than 300 million people, that means there are about 60,000 Americans who have some measure of DSD, of a disorder of sexual development. Disorder can manifest itself in many ways. Ambiguous external genitalia, the normal reproductive external organs that you would see just not being right. That doesn't mean that they're all wrong. Of course, in all of these disorders, there's a whole continuum and spectrum of gravity. Some very small that can be fixed very small. Some very large that maybe can never be fixed. Disorders manifest themselves in many ways, like ambiguous external genitalia, a mismatch between the internal and external reproductive organs, where you might have male genitalia on the outside, but on the inside have ovaries. Incomplete development of reproductive organs, and even the formation of two sets, of opposing sex organs. These disorders are most often caused by chromosomal or hormonal defects, by genetic mutations, or by chromosomal abnormalities at the time of fertilization. Disorders of sexual development are pathologies in the development of the male or female body. They don't constitute multiple new sexes. Their reality has been understood by human beings and known by human beings from time immemorial. It didn't lead human beings to think that there were more than two sexes, or that these pathologies are unique identities. Biological sex is rooted in the way that we are organized to embrace the other and to reproduce the image of God. Reproductive organs, testicles or ovaries, this is all that there is. There's no third gonad. There's no third sexual organ. If there are problems in the development of those two, those problems don't create a third or a fourth or a fifth standard. Some of the common sexual development disorders I want to mention, for instance, Klinefelter syndrome is when a person has 47 chromosomes instead of 46 and are XXY. They develop as males, but they have abnormal body proportions and often have breasts that look female. Turner syndrome is when someone has 45 chromosomes with a single X rather than an X or XY. They develop as women, but are infertile, since two X chromosomes are necessary for the normal development of the ovaries. Most disorders of sexual development are grouped in three categories: XY, XX, and those with more than one set of chromosomes who develop both ovarian and testicular cell lines and genitals. Classically, we call a person suffering from this kind of disorder a hermaphrodite. Today, more typically, they're called ovotesticular disorder. Traditionally, medical science has understood these disorders as pathologies and have tried in treating people who have these unique disorders to understand, to discern what the underlying sex is, and have taken measures to promote the potential for sexual intercourse and fertility. So if you're a doctor with a person who has a disorder, a significant disorder like this, you would try to discern at its root, often a genetic root, if the person is male or female, and you would try to take the action that would best help them to have the potential to be able to reproduce. Based upon your evaluation, you would determine if there was hormonal treatment that was necessary or possibly even surgery. The modern LGBT movement would like to interpret diversity, these disorders as diversity, not disorders. They like to interpret pathologies as simply another way of expressing something natural. They would like DSDs to be renamed differences in sexual development, not disorders of sexual development. And the change of those words has massive implications. In fact, not only do they want to elevate this tiny minority of those who suffer from sexual pathologies, they want to privilege, as our culture loves to privilege minorities. They want to give them privileges, suggesting that if we don't do this, that we will be hurting those who are suffering from these disorders. The word disorder is important to affirm, because saying that word manifests our conviction that there are such a thing as natural norms, that the human race is bifurcated between male and female according to God's original plan. If everything's normal, nothing's normal. And of course, if you accept this, then you skew the function of how to define a human being and their whole purpose for reproduction. If we applied the same postmodern advocacy that you find in the transgendered ideologues to other issues of health, just think what would happen. If you had lungs that did not properly process oxygen, would it help you if a doctor said, no, that's not a pathology, that's just another type of lung? If you had a heart that wasn't pumping blood like it needed to pump, but the doctor said, that's not a disorder, that's not a pathology that we should try to treat, that's just another type of heart, is that going to help you? If you have kidneys that don't process waste appropriately, do we expect doctors to say, that's just another type of kidney, without reference to the clear, natural purpose of the organ? Most people with DSDs have nothing to do with the transgender movement. And most transgenders are not people who are suffering from DSDs. They're imposing their ideology into the conversation of disorders of sexual development. And their rejection of normative and natural biological norms is behind this effort. Now let me say a few things about specifically about sex change surgeries and the process of transitioning. I want to share especially from the works of the late Dr. Hermann Engelhardt, the really fine Orthodox philosopher and bioethicist. He actually held double professorships, one at Rice University in philosophy and one at Baylor University in medicine. He was an MD, PhD, and a good friend of this parish and a good friend of mine. His loss to the Orthodox community was massive. He has written a lot of wonderful material on the subject of medical ethics, kind of a standard Christian account of bioethics. And he has a lot to say about how our faith views sex reassignment surgery. And I want to end my talk by talking about that and sharing with you that. First, the disregard of God's providence in biology is the foundation for the idea of transitioning, the idea that you can change your sex. As I mentioned, there are some who are even physicians now who are, and other medical experts who are advocating for a redefinition of sex. I read today an interesting expert opinion that was written in May of 2016 by a physician named Deanna Adkins. It was written for the U.S. District Court, the Middle District of North Carolina, by a woman who is the founder of the Duke Center for Child and Adolescent Gender Care. Her whole life is dealing with young people between the ages of 7 and 20 who have various levels of gender dysphoria. And she was asked to give a professional expert opinion in writing for a court case. And this is what she said, quote, "From a medical perspective, the appropriate determinant of sex is gender identity," unquote. Not only is that completely, totally ridiculous, and not, in fact, at all representative of standard medical practice, but it's extremely, extremely revolutionary. All of the things that I was describing to you before that constitute being male and female, she's saying none of those are as important. None of those can be trusted. As a matter of fact, she describes the traditional definition of male or female with a biological root as, quote, extremely harmful to individuals. She says, quote, "It's harmful to make sex assignments based on characteristics other than gender identity." They want us to think that a person's gender identity, their own self-concept of who they are, is immutable and innate and unchangeable. Those are her words. Immutable, innate, and unchangeable. If you were listening last week, you know how totally ridiculous that commentary is. We have a contagion right now of young girls whose gender identity is absolutely mutable and changing more quickly than you can document. Those who embrace transgender ideology believe that gender identity is, and not biology, is what's fundamental, and that all must conform to it. This is where the idea of the existence of a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body comes from. Transitioning by hormone treatment and restructuring anatomy to align with a person's self-perception is supposed to bring harmony. But hormones and anatomical surgery cannot, quote, reassign sex. Sex reassignment surgery is not a true definition of what that surgery it is, because sex can't be reassigned. You can't just chopping off your breasts or taking hormones so that you grow a beard does not make you a sex other than what you are in your biology. In fact, this approach to the creation, this approach to the physical, smells deeply, deeply of the heresy of Gnosticism, a real disregard of the physical and an affirmation of the independence of the invisible and the soul over the physical. It also has a lot to do with the man-centeredness of the sexual revolution and the rejection of sexual norms, the idea that we are who we say we are, as though we're the architect of our existence instead of God being the architect of our existence. And there's nothing that's more fundamental than what God has made you as a male or a female. If you want to rebel against that, if you want to say, no, I determine, there's no better way to do it than attempting to affirm that you're a sex that you aren't. It's an attempted coup versus the Creator. This is how the canons of the church view this kind of thing. A radical rebellion against nature. And we know, sadly, that when we rebel against God and when we rebel against nature, we always lose. We always become miserable. We always end up in terrible grief. Nobody wins in a fight against God. No one wins in a fight against nature. We lose every time. So what's the church's counsel on transitioning and sex reassignment surgery? Well, we have canons from the earliest period of the church against physical mutilation for sexual purposes. Canon 22 of the Apostolic Canons reads this way: let no one who has mutilated himself become a clergyman, for he is a murderer of himself and an enemy of God's creation. This canon, this early canon, is being articulated by the church, especially in response to misunderstandings of Jesus' teaching in the Gospels, where Jesus said things like this: if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it from you, because it's better to enter into life maimed than to have two hands and to go to hell. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it far from you, because it's better to enter into life with one eye than to have two eyes and to go into hellfire, where the flames are never quenched. Some attempted to pluck out their sexual organs. Men castrated themselves, thinking that they could remove the temptation of lust by simply cutting off their male organ. And the church here very clearly says that is absolutely forbidden. It's a terrible misinterpretation of our Savior's teaching. And it is a form of attacking yourself, what's called self-murder in the canons, and it's an assault on creation. It's actually blaming God for a problem which is a matter of your will, your heart, and your mind, and how you exercise your freedom. The solution to lust is not by chopping off your male member, if you're a man. It's to purifying your heart and taking custody of your mind. This is the path. And thus the church articulated this so clearly. Surgical shortcuts are not blessed. Canon 1 of the First Ecumenical Council of Nicaea expounds on this. It says, if anyone has been operated upon by surgeons for a disease or has been excised by barbarians, he can stay a priest. This means that if you have a disease in the sexual organs and the doctors have to eunuchize you for that reason, or if you get captured by the barbarians and they do terrible things to you, it's not your fault. And you can't be thrown out of the priesthood. Keep the barbarians far away from us. But the canon continues, if anyone has excised himself while being healthy, he must be dismissed, even if he is examined after being in the clergy. Bet you didn't know just how much bishops are supposed to examine candidates for ordination, did you? Yeah, it's not just a mental and spiritual examination, if you understand what I'm saying. Eunuchs who eunuchize themselves can't become clergymen. We must never act against our physical integrity as a man or as a woman. Dr. Engelhardt writes, commenting on this, a lot about how to understand these. We can't attack, he says, the embodied basis of our own sexual identity. In 681 in the Trullo canons, canon 8, the church mentions this again. The person who eunuchizes himself is a self-murderer, and so is the surgeon who assists him. Ooh, extending the forbiddance not just to the person who's obtaining the surgery, but to the doctor who's helping. This is an attack upon creation. In castration, the goal is to eliminate one's sexual passions, while in sex change surgery, the goal is to redirect them. But both are forbidden as attacks on the body and attacks on creation. Commenting on sex change surgery, Dr. Engelhardt says, quote, surgical and hormonal interventions to change sexual phenotype presentation involve surgically restructuring sexual embodiment in a fashion that mutilates original anatomical sexual identity because this anatomical identity is rejected. Such interventions collide with the spirit of the early church and her canons, which require accepting the sexual character of one's embodiment. One may correct malformations. You can have surgery to correct a deficiency. And to restore lost functions so as to allow the realization of the embodied identity of being male or female. Although sexual identity may be unclear in many cases, this is important, this comment. Although sexual identity may be unclear in many cases, 1 in 5,000, to some degree, the Christian insight is that gender is not a social creation. The statement in Genesis that God created humans as man and woman, along with the affirmation in the Gospels by Christ, provide a normatively canonical account of humanity as sexually dimorphic. Genesis declares male and female he made them, and the Gospel that announces, ye read, did ye not, that the one who made them from the beginning made them male and female. Matthew 19. The deep reality of humans is as either male or female, no matter how difficult this reality is to discern. All surgical and other interventions should therefore be directed as far as possible to maintaining or determining and then restoring a person's sexual identity. Usually, but not always, this identity can be gleaned from the genotypic, from your genes, your genotypic sexual identity. Here as elsewhere, in a world radically broken by sin, much that should be clear will at all times be painfully obscure. Under such circumstances, one must attempt as best as one can, with medical and spiritual discernment, to aim at reconstituting that which ought to have been. This is an incredible statement there, full of humility and for a medical doctor to acknowledge his limitations like this is very beautiful to see. Under such circumstances, one must attempt as best as one can with medical and spiritual discernment. Notice the emphasis from this doctor on spiritual discernment. He says in several places in his chapter on sex reassignment surgery that sometimes it's so bad, the best solution is to take someone to a God-bearing elder and ask the elder to discern by prayer what sex this person is, and then to accept that and to follow it. Of course, he's talking about really advanced forms of disorder. He's not talking about someone who's clearly one sex and just feels something else. That's not what he's talking about at all. He's talking about people who have two sets of sex hormones. And even in some cases, extremely, extremely rare, conflicting chromosomal structures, some XX and some XY, and which is almost impossible for anyone to discern. Under such circumstances, one must attempt as best as one can with medical and spiritual discernment to aim at reconstituting that which ought to have been. In our broken world, it may at times be very difficult for some children unambiguously to take possession of their proper sexual identity. In some cases, for example, genotypic males may display, because of a benign feminizing tumor, female sexual characteristics. As a consequence, they may marry as a woman and only later come to medical attention when unable to bear a child. Under such circumstances and with spiritual guidance, healthcare professionals may be able to acquiesce in accepting this manifest female sexual identity as the sexual identity of the person. But there would be strong grounds for not doing so if the woman were the wife of a priest, for their union should be an unambiguous icon of the unique joining of Adam and Eve. Anyone who underwent surgical interventions to change sexual phenotype should be barred. Let me say that again slow. Anyone who underwent surgical interventions to change sexual phenotype, they had sex assignment, sex change surgery, should be barred from sacramental marriage, not to mention from the priesthood. Medicine should be engaged in preserving and restoring the normatively human as male and female. Okay. So this is just a brief attempt to comment upon the significance of being male and female in God's creation, and to provide some commentary with that as a foundation upon how we would address unique circumstances. Because these unique circumstances, the tiny proportion of disorders of sexual development, are being used by the transgender ideologues to undercut and eradicate natural norms and traditional anthropology of man being in two sexes. Okay. Questions? Questions that you'd like to me to address? Please, David. Yes. If I understand the question correctly, which is, when you have chromosomal abnormalities that manifest particularly in pathological development of sexual organs, are there other diseases that afflict them? And that the answer is yes. It depends on that particular disease. But yes, there's often a wide range. It's not just confined just to the sexual organs. Yes, Adriana. I really want to answer that on two levels. On the basic level, where most people who are experiencing this dysphoria, I don't think it's that developed at all. I think that they have certain levels of pathology that are greatly hyped because of our culture and are terribly manipulated and propagandized to take a certain approach to treatment without really thinking about the consequences. You remember some of the stories I shared last time from Abigail Schreier, who has done such a fantastic job in her book on irreversible damage, how the transgender craze is seducing our daughters. It's an incredible text where she talks about that it's a true social contagion. Social contagions are not thought out, principled decisions. These are girls, mostly girls, who are literally mental, suffering from mental instability and being driven into this as a group experience, as a group phenomenon. We know a lot of diseases that have anorexia nervosa as one of them, bulimia and others that are very, very influenced by social contagion. But then on the larger level, the level of articulate, professorial, pure secularists who are behind, for instance, the LGBT cause, people who write for them, they're very clear. This was something that, you know, 10 or 15 years ago when we were really, the church was really fighting to defend marriage against homosexual marriage, against gay marriage, something that we spent a lot of time, I spent a lot of time literally right here and in our old hall reading material from traditional material. We have lots of it from the 1960s up until 2003, in which these LGBT advocates attacked the concept of marriage night and day from every angle. They despise it. They view it as a religious and patriarchal imposition. They know that they'll never have their world as long as it exists. It only became fashionable to suggest that the LGBT movement wanted gay marriage when they saw it as a political tool. They knew that if they embraced it as a political tool, if they kept making it clear that they literally despised marriage, they were very clear in literature. Oh, very, in their journals, in op-ed pieces, very, very clear, for years, decades, until this major political shift, and they recognized that the country was vulnerable and that they could appeal to people's sensibility of excluding them because they really had the great loving ambition to enter into marriage and we were keeping them from that. And you should be able to love who you want to love. Anybody who had known their material know that they were lying out their teeth. And of course they were. As soon as they got marriage, a tiny, tiny percentage of gays actually, they don't like marriage. They still don't like marriage. And they certainly, even those who are in long-time relationships, certainly don't respect fidelity. Sexual fidelity is not a virtue at all, even in long-term sexual relationships between people of the same sex in the movement. So this, just like there were the masterminds then, there are the masterminds now. They know exactly what they're doing without question, without question. And they have been very successful. I would say if you really want to get to the source, all you have to do is go to the website of the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, which is the most well-funded and the largest advocate of the LGBT cause in the world. Very, very well-funded. I first ran into the HRC about, I think it must have been 2014 or 15 when I started working with the World Congress of Families. And at that time, the chairman of the World Congress of Families was a wonderful man named Larry Jacobs, who was a dear friend of mine. Sadly, he suffered a massive heart attack, even though he's younger than I am. Suffered a massive heart attack a few years ago and passed away. But they published, HRC publishes a yearly document of the greatest enemies, basically the greatest enemies of the human race. You know, these are the people that are holding America back. And they dedicated, he was one of their top 20 in the United States because why? He was doing the terrible thing of supporting marriage between a man and a woman. I mean, like full exposés. This is him. These are his children. Oh, yeah. Dark. Dark. Yeah, HRC. May God wipe that organization off the face of the earth. Any other questions before I give you a blessing? Yes. That's a wonderful question. So there's clearly a social contagion that's driving young girls into transgenderism and the rejection of traditional sexual norms. Is there a similar environmental contagion is the question that David's asking. It's a great question. Since we know that at the root of many of these disorders of sexual development are unnatural overloads or underproduction of certain sexual hormones, especially of testosterone and estrogen. And is there a connection perhaps to those chemicals in our own environment. There is a lot of work being done in this area, a lot of examination being done. I just printed out a 95-page article today from the New Atlantis dedicated to a lot of these types of questions, expanding kind of the research behind it. So I remember how young this is. I mean, I never even would have dreamed of giving talks like this just 5 years ago. I mean, no one would have come, like, who cares? I mean, yeah, okay, whatever. But today, it's just exploding. So I would not be surprised at all if you see articles coming out about this subject. Please share them with me if you see them, and I'll try to remember to share them with you if I see them. I'm hoping for at least one more lecture, although probably two. And the more I was trying to contain myself today, I was thinking, oh, maybe we should just do 10. But I'm like, no, they're never gonna stick with me. They're never gonna stick with me for this. So see you next week. If you stand, I'll give you a blessing. The blessings of the Holy Trinity, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, be with you tonight and forevermore. Amen. Good night, y'all.